The following content is provided under a Creative Commons license. Your support will help MIT OpenCourseWare continue to offer high-quality educational resources for free. To make a donation or view additional materials from hundreds of MIT courses, visit MIT OpenCourseWare at ocw.mit.edu.
Before we move on to the rest of the topics, maybe just some administrative stuff about the next assignment. So the idea is to model a system, right? So the idea is to pick some sort of real-world system. In the past, people have picked stuff like applying for college because they knew all about that. People have talked about an example I give is, you know, running a nuclear reactor or something. Just recently, if any of you are nuclear science majors, you know, oh, perfect. Okay. one of my favorite Apple II games was actually nuclear reactor simulation. It always melted down. That's why it was fun. But yeah, you know, pick a real world system to model to start modeling. Obviously, you're trying to find the fun. Obviously, you're trying to make something that people are going to enjoy playing. But the idea is to start from a slightly different place from where we had in the first assignment. Now, a couple of you guys already did that for the first assignment, though. I mean, things like picking up girls at a party. I mean, you're modeling a real world system in a sense. We still haven't played the genealogy game yet, so we're going to play that tomorrow. We'll see that. The survival horror game, I would say, is not a real world system. It was a system.
Tasers, raptors.
Yeah, or wizards.
Natural enemies.
Pick something. We've seen games. Negotiating greenhouse gas emissions. That was one which was really, really cutthroat, as you would probably imagine. I'll try to get that team to come in late in the semester to talk about their card game. It was a freshman team on Telescope. On Wednesday, we're going to do the usual brainstorming exercise in the second half of the class. You know, everybody throw out your ideas, come in with a bunch of ideas. We'll try to build on that. But this time around, you're allowed to actually pre-build your team. You're allowed to ask people, you know, hey, you guys want to work together. You don't actually have to, like, figure it out on the spot if you don't want to. I don't really care how you do it, as long as by Friday, you know who your team is. Who's entering? Team sizes are the same. So, any questions?
Yeah. Are we able to simulate things that aren't from like this era?
Yeah. Okay. Like from history?
Yeah.
Okay. Not from like the future.
Oh. No. Right. I'm thinking like people, like
real yeah, sure. Future.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure. It's like this is how things are going to work. Well, I mean. Okay. So yes. Absolutely. Historical stuff. But you do have some liberties. I'm not saying that your game has to be a faithful simulation. We're getting a little bit more into simulation on Wednesday. But it doesn't have to be a faithful simulation necessarily of what you're talking about. But, you know, in a sense, you're trying to, like, capture the spirit of it. If the point is I'm running a nuclear reactor and you can sort of capture the oh my god it's so dangerous or the oh my god it's so boring aspect of it. Have you actually worked on a nuclear reactor yet?
Well, I went there. Yeah. And I know like the mechanics of it, but I didn't work there.
I've been told it's not necessarily the most exciting job in the world.
No, yeah, you just sit there and do your homework and every once in a while you look up.
That's very reasonable.
And they get paid for it, like yeah. 12 or 13 bucks an hour or something.
Yeah, so you know, if the whole idea of the game is let's try to get as much homework done without them, yeah, that might be more entertaining than just like looking
at it. Reactor going critical.
But I got my problems in there.
Just plus one out of points.
Can you have to do homework while you get a board game?
Wow.
That would be terrible. That would be the worst game ever.
Wait, this what happens if you have this, right?
You have to finish your piece this time.
Your game may be too meta at that point. And besides, but I think we still have a time limit, like half an hour or something like that. You know, it's like, yeah,
it's not good for homework.
We have some really easy homework. Certainly not homework. Let's see. Just a reminder for everyone who hasn't, who's been falling off on the forum posts, please make sure that you keep up on your forum posts. Those things actually do affect your grade. Again, we're expecting one person, not one team. So if you have any opinions, since we're in between reading assignments right now, you can write about the assignment. But if you wrote up something, let's say a reflection on how the past assignment went, you know, that's fine. We're not expecting more than one forum post a week. Of course, feel free to comment on other people's forum posts as well. And those, if you wanted, like, if there's a discussion or a point that's been raised that's kind of interesting and you want to kind of develop on that, you know, put some thought into it, write something interesting that's going to keep on the conversation, that counts too. And that's fine. Okay, so puzzles. So Brenda's. Okay, so actually, before I start with Brenda, let's start with Scott's. What were some of the definitions or some of the things that Scott Kim was mentioning that were good for puzzle design?
That was the reading not in the book, right? Huh? That was one in the book or not in the book?
This was the webpage.
Difficulty.
Fun and has a right answer.
Yeah.
That's actually a solution. Yeah.
But actually, create.
He didn't really differentiate between like kind of like puzzles that could be generated, you know, like a Sudoku or something where you kind of have an algorithm that lets you create multiple puzzles, but as long as that particular iteration had the right answer, so that was really clear. Anything else?
Talked a lot about difficulty.
Mm-hmm.
Make it accessible, but not super easy.
Right.
There's any targeting a specific audience.
There's also the ability to change the difficulty. Was it dynamic difficulty?
Mm-hmm.
So some areas may actually be easier settings, and then actually what they want it to be in harder settings.
Mm-hmm. I think that was Brenda's, but
there's also the distinction between sort of like types of difficulty, like you know things where you know the letter puzzle that he has at the beginning where mm-hmm. it requires sort of like thinking about it, figuring out.
I got it right away.
It was patience versus something else. I can remember the other term he used. But then you have things like mazes where it's all patience, where you have to like be very like careful and work your way through.
And sometimes they like bringing in information from other domains, from outside of the puzzle. It's not just like all the information is currently in the puzzle. But the interesting thing about the puzzle that he particularly shows is that he shows a range of different ways to actually solve it, none of which are actually satisfying except for the final answer, which he irritatingly does not tell you. He gives you another puzzle.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, cool. It's kind of interesting to think about actually what's the audience for those kinds of specific puzzles. I mean, there are magazines out there, like Games Magazine in particular, but sometimes you see stuff nestled into magazines that are not just about games. You see stuff like crossword puzzles and newspapers and everything like that. And now things like Sudoku and all that are becoming way more popular. That are, you know, that are meant to be really, really mass audience, whereas a magazine that is specifically targeted at puzzle enthusiasts can be like super hardcore. But of course, if it's a whole magazine, then you can have like a whole range of different difficulties in there. You know, the assumption that you can solve something is not so good.
Out of interest, does anybody know, like, really actually know how people in newspapers generate crossword puzzles and Sudoku puzzles? Like, does anybody know what the actual process behind that is? Because I don't know, right? I can imagine how you might do it. You might start with the filled out thing and then, like, remove bits to get your Sudoku. Or you might brute force dictionary search to come up with words which fit together in order to form a crossword.
What they do with Sudoku now is they have some, like, computer algorithm and it has scales difficulty and it generates a random Sudoku puzzle from your input.
Yeah. That's kind of how I thought
it. Sudoku is solved enough that you can actually just algorithmically generate for like an actual, you know, numerical difficulty. You scale it from, you know, like 1 to 10, 10 being where there's like literally only one step to take at each point.
The one that took 3 months to solve.
something.
But like crosswords, there's people actually who just get paid to sit down and generate those.
Will Shorts. Will Shorts. New York Times takes submissions from other people. And that's why it was edited by Will Shorts, because people submit stuff and then he kind of like just touches it up.
So he kind of crowdsources crossword puzzle generation.
Yeah, I'm sure
at this point,
I'm sure he's been
in the past. Yeah. I think he created his own.
But I mean, so the difficulty in a crossword puzzle isn't just like in the sort of geometric layout of how the words go. Is the specific clues that they give you can be more or less obfuscated in some ways. And New York Times in particular is super irritating with this. They'll give you like two words that with no grammatical context about how that's supposed to fit in.
Well, it gets harder during the week.
So you can actually compare it and see how that difficulty scaling is just by looking at the clues, not even looking at the puzzle itself. And of course, the other thing about crosswords is, just to bring up the point that we talked about in an earlier class, it's that the crosswords that we're familiar with at least are dependent on the redundancy of the English language, right? You don't need every single letter of a word in order to figure out what that word is, so that if there's a word that you couldn't otherwise have gotten from a clue, you can still get it just by seeing the letters that are available. And that's because the English language is kind of about 50% redundant information. If you dropped every single vowel in a sentence, you could probably still make out what that sentence said. And you don't necessarily get that with Chinese, for instance. How many folks here there are probably other languages here where like every single character can mean a word or something like that.
Hebrew has no vowels, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, they use them until third grade, and they start dropping them after that. So it's basically because it is understandable without vowels, you eventually just stop using them.
So that's interesting. If you had a crossword in Hebrew that where you expected to write in the words with vowels, you probably could actually do it the one very similar to an English one.
It's difficult because the vowels in Hebrew are attached to a letter, not a separate character. There's just dots above or below a letter, like a dots or a bar below.
But you wonder if in Hebrew in a crossword and a letter can make a different sound with both.
Because a V can be vo or va or ve, you don't know, you only know by context.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, based on an English one, like C can be kind of a hard or soft.
Or G, tweak, ja.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true, but although in English in particular, the phonetic meaning, the way how a certain word is pronounced isn't necessarily essential for solving a crossword puzzle, unless the clues happen to be phonetic clues. Sounds like a fish. So that may not come in so much play when it comes to English in particular. Jason, you had your hand up earlier about Sudoku?
It was going to comment on the algorithmic difficulty.
Well, also, one thing about algorithmic, about Sudoku difficulty, a lot of it comes on the selective removal of numbers. It's not what is the final number, the final pattern going to look like that's actually the difficulty. It's how do we remove the numbers in a way that gives multiple possible answers or multiple possible dead ends, because really there's only one solution at the end of it. I'm not actually familiar with the algorithm which does so, but it seems to be very clear that there are at least two algorithms, one of which is very easy, which is just provide a legitimate Sudoku solution, and then the one that's slightly harder is which numbers to be removed so that it's still solvable. Have people played Picross? Someone want to describe it for the folks who aren't familiar with it? And we can use a whiteboard if...
Sure. Mark was on the show.
I think the green one works better.
The green one?
Works better. Yeah, I remember it was better than the black.
I'm really only familiar with Picross 3D, so it's the same. You know, maybe worth my hands.
Yeah, that's a better way for it. Sorry to put you on the spot, like this.
So, the idea is that you'll have words and columns. And then they'll have some number.
Oh, this. This one where you spill in the blocks.
Okay, and then And then given this information, we have to work out which of these blocks is filled and which can be removed. And the idea is that the number tells you the number of blocks in that row or column which has a filled block in it.
So it's like my paper, but like...
So in this case, like,
well, they're also given
nothing in this column, this column, and that column can have anything in it. And this is probably not actually a great example, because that is probably the numbers out of...
Then they have the sums are the same.
But yeah.
So you get the idea.
So it's not going to work, but you get the idea. And then things can get more complicated. So additionally, if there's just, I think, a 3, then it means that there's a connected block of 3. So for instance, this, that, and that might all have to be filled in.
Yeah.
But if there's a 3, which I think is in like a square or something along these lines, that means that there are 3 in that column, but there's a gap in there somewhere. And then if it's at like a 3 in a circle or something else complicated like that, then it means that there are 3, but they all have gaps between them.
Yeah. I've also seen versions where they have just like a list of numbers, and those are the, there are consecutive blocks of that length.
So
for one column you might say like 2, 3, 5, which means there is a block of 2 followed by a block of 3 followed by a block of 5.
And they have to have a gap between them.
And we will have to have a gap in between them, so it's not like there's actually a block of 8 in there somewhere.
Yeah.
But the whole idea is that, you know, you've got this information that is actually redundant. You know, you've got more information in there than you necessarily need to be able to figure out which blocks in the solution should be filled and which should be empty. But, you know, it's presented to you in this obfuscated way, the evidence, the clues that are given to you in a way that, you know, that requires you to perform these algorithms in order to figure out which ones should be shaded. And usually that's an algorithm that you can use to solve. Although, you know, like, I think Kim was the one who was talking about pattern matching, that was better. But, you know, eventually, as you get good at these things, you start to recognize patterns right off the bat, right? Like, that's a 0. Oh, wow, okay, so that entire row is empty. That's the sort of thing that you, that becomes automatic after you do a bit of that. So, let's see. I'm not sure if I have much left more to talk about Scott Kim, but, you know, These are more like generated stuff. Tip over. Has anyone seen this? So this basically is it's along the lines of what Scott Kim is talking about, but obviously this is more physical, not a pen and paper kind of thing.
Can you move it to the copy yet?
Oh, move the copy? No, I just want you to look at this.
Okay.
Look at this first. Don't look at that. Don't look at that. So the basic idea is, let me just start with one. You get a card that's actually a puzzle. I wish we were doing this outside now because I could have zoomed this out. But the puzzle basically just tells you how you're supposed to set up your board initially. So there's there's a green guy there, there's a green guy there. This is supposed to be an easy puzzle. I hope it is, because I'm really bad at this. Red guy goes there, I think. Yeah, and that's the puzzle. And then, and there's one with a little square on it, and then you have this check.
What? That's cool.
That's awesome.
So the basic idea is you tip over the pieces so that the guy moves. And you don't want to be tipping over the pieces in a way where the guy can't move anymore.
So you're tipping over things to make a path that he can walk along, right?
Yeah.
And make a closed loop.
And he has to touch every piece?
I think he just has to get to this one.
Yeah, he just has to get to the red one.
There's a plus mark.
So knock it that way and then bring this one.
Yeah. Yes, I agree.
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure how to solve this one.
So yellow that way, green.
Yeah.
Yellow that way.
Yeah.
Wait, you're allowed to tip him over?
Yeah.
Does he die?
My understanding is that he needs to fall onto another piece, actually.
Oh.
So let me just confirm I set this up right, actually. Yeah, I did.
No, so you push the yellow that way, and then the green that way, and the other green that way.
So put the yellow one first?
So do the green ones first. Right?
Yeah,
I don't understand the rules for the guy.
Yellow, yeah. Exactly. And then
put the green one
there? No, it doesn't.
Yeah, I
how does heat fall?
I will verify this.
No,
how
this
is
my vote is heat.
Oh,
he's
no,
a
he's actually allowed to move on anything that's contiguously connected. So as long as you can contiguously connect up to this, you're fine.
So
same height.
Tip the second green over. So tip that first green. No, other way. Yeah,
then
that's from a path, right? Now if you tip
that,
oh, there's a hole.
Yeah,
that's
the
hole.
Are you sure tip over means move over one spot or not?
Well, if it doesn't, then you can't reach the red ever.
Yeah, I am absolutely sure it means that you're supposed to tip it over in a way that
this
is supposed to be a beginner's
mistake. Tip the yellow over first, then move the guy onto the green, then tip over the green.
Oh, right.
Wait,
right.
Can you do that?
Yeah. Think you are.
Oh. What?
That was crazy. That is why it's supposed to be a beginner puzzle. I thought about it. You can actually do it. This is why this is puzzle one.
You don't have to fall on top of anything? That's bizarre.
Yeah. Instinct is, you want to build a path that you can walk on.
Right? You don't want to fall, so it makes no sense.
Yeah, the guy is probably not making sense. But you know, this is not entirely unlike the kind of puzzles that Scott does. I mean, sure, this is one particular piece of plastic that the game is designed to work with. But basically, it's just, you know, it's like a book, right? It's like a book of puzzles. So there are also solutions in here, but I find the solutions harder to read than the puzzles.
Pattern recognition was in the book.
Was in Brenda's book?
Yeah.
So actually, that's probably a good excuse to switch over to Brenda's. Before that, I want to talk a little bit about Tangrams. I mean, everyone played the Tangrams?
Yes.
I think I played.
No. Okay. So you know, the basic idea is you've got these shapes. Is this magnetic? Yeah, it is.
Cool.
You've got these shapes, and if you assemble them right. As the box, this is usually displayed on the side of a box somewhere. Where the heck? I'm really bad on
the inside.
I've got a big picture on the side. Is that you can actually fit all of these shapes inside that square. So these are basically just a square that's been divided in a specific way. So. Once I got this assembled, everyone can just like pass this around. Anyone who's already seen it can pass it on. That one doesn't fit very well, but it works well enough. Hey, ta-da! Yay! So this is the basic set. This is how it's been sold, at least, is that this is actually a calendar. So every day you get a different shape. It's a cute little thing. You know, some of them are pretty rudimentary, like geometric shapes. Some of them have, like, I think this is supposed to be a sphinx or something.
Yeah,
it looks like a frog.
Yeah,
it's
like a frog.
This looks like a Pac-Man. So the idea is that you rearrange those particular shapes into all of these different shapes and. It's you could play the game without getting these puzzle solutions, right? And Scott Kim talks a lot about, like, first, if you've got a toy that's worth playing with, now you've got the beginning of something that would be that might make a good game. The nice thing about tip over is that it's kind of fun to tip over things. And the thing about Tangrams is that I actually had more fun playing with Tangrams than trying to solve a specific problem, just trying to rearrange these. Who hasn't seen these before?
Wow. You should be ashamed of yourself.
And
all the work that you did is gone.
But that's the thing, is that as a toy, it doesn't really matter, right? Because it's just a set of pieces that can be configured in anything, and you kind of want to take it apart and make new shapes with it, like a little house. So, if you've got something that's kind of fun to fiddle with to begin with, you've got
possibly the beginning of a game in general. But the way how Scott was talking about it, there's this intermediate step where it's a puzzle. You know, it's a toy with a specific solution that you're trying to get to. And then game is kind of like one step beyond that, where now there's like multiple solutions and competitive. At least that's how he was constructing it. He's not really a game theorist, he just works on puzzles.
He talks about in terms of a goal, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, mm-hmm. So that with a toy that you don't have a goal, but then with a puzzle you have
one goal.
You have one goal with no interaction, and then a game is many with interaction.
And possibly multiple goals as well. But again, it becomes more and more directed, whereas toy is very freeform. So there are people who describe games like The Sims, for instance, as actually toys. You know, and in the same way that you describe a dollhouse as a toy, the Sims is kind of like a digital dollhouse. But later versions of The Sims kind of like added more and more specific roles, like, you know, and now you have to throw a party with at least 5 people in it, or you have to attain career level, you know, 5 or something like that. I can't remember exactly how they measured it. But then that kind of like has that goal. We are going to give more and more specific things for you to work towards. But The Sims is very careful not to lose its toy sense. The sense of you can, if you really wanted to just dig around with these guys, just go right ahead. Just play around with them and see what happens.
Why is there a distinction for physical objects between toys and games, but for like video games, like Minecraft,
mm-hmm.
is technically still a game,
mm-hmm.
but it
kind of has different modes. Yeah,
I guess it has different modes, but it's more of a toy, I think.
I would say that's entirely marketing. That's the only reason is people haven't figured out how to sell digital toys. And there are games aisles in like Best Buy and so there's this fun thing we're gonna put in the game section. Everyone starts calling it games. And that's kind of the same thing with The Sims. It's like really The Sims should be its own genre, but you can't sell its own genre that well.
Gotcha.
So we just
wasn't
a hand over here? Okay, so that's some of the stuff with Brenda's reading. So let's move on to Brenda's. And she's very specific about the kinds of puzzles that she's talking about. There's these things that get in the way of a very specific narrative experience that a game wants to guide you through. She describes them more as roadblocks than anything else. But you know, things to sort of like make the challenge higher, but possibly so high that no one's going to be able to get past them. Some of her examples are things that come up as sort of intermittent but optional mechanics, like hacking in Bioshock. And sometimes there are like things that you have to solve, especially in adventure games. There's this, you have to combine this object with that object and bring it to a specific location. And then now you have to, you know, and now you can proceed with whatever narrative you've got.
She had this specific axe to grind against puzzles having meaningful rewards or not being completely blocking. So, for instance, she says you should never have a puzzle being required to open a door. She said solve a puzzle and then get some kind of tangible reward like loot or something. This is after I'd spent like the bus ride to New York City playing Professor Layton in the
nice.
Which was like non-stop. We found a door, it's got a lock on it, it looks like a puzzle. So I wasn't entirely sure what to make of that. I thought that like my Professor Layton experience was fine and
mm-hmm.
I didn't need to get fat Layton loot.
that's actually something. Yeah, and there's a really good article actually written by Clara over in our lab. Actually, it wasn't an article. It was a transcript of a talk that she gave at Austin UDC. I'll send out the link to everyone about how you can integrate and why you should integrate puzzles really, really well in the narrative. It's like, really, why is there a puzzle in your game at all unless it's been integrated into narrative? And Brenda seems to be sort of providing a cautionary tale of the, but if you do it badly, no one can get on with the story, no one can enjoy the rest of the game. It becomes this one thing that prevents you from proceeding. Is there anyone who kind of had that moment and then, yeah.
About 5 minutes into Miss.
Seriously.
I think it was Mystery. I don't know. They had sort of some cool, like, live action video and stuff, and it looked like it could be like an interesting story. And I was kind of amused with the technological prowess of integrating like video into 3D. And then suddenly I like looked into the picture, and I was on an island, and then there was nothing happening, and I had to turn things to face each other, and I couldn't figure it out.
When I originally played The Legend of Zelda, the original one, where, so, I don't know if you don't, so they didn't tell you anything, pretty much. And so the temples, you just walk around this sun that's like, okay, there's a tree in a forest. You're supposed to burn this particular one, and there's the entrance to this temple that you can't perceive until you do this thing. And so it's just like, how am I supposed to know that I'm supposed to burn this particular tree in the middle of this huge map?
Did you beat any of the other...
Yeah, and they didn't say anything.
No, I mean the other Zeldas?
Yeah. Actually, yesterday we acted in time again, so...
Yeah, cool.
I mean, that tells you...
I was just saying, so the interesting thing is, so most people nowadays, they end up playing, like, the Ocarina of Time and George Mask, and they're moving backwards, so they end up playing Zelda, the first Zelda, after having played these old ones.
Yes.
So you sort of know that you're expected to do these random things to get, like, across. So I feel like it's easier for people, but then...
But again, with the original Zelda, you know how in new ones, they have, like, it's like, let's say a wall you can blow up. It's discolored or something. And in this one, every tree looks exactly the same. They use the same sprites.
If I remember correctly, though, it's placed such that it's, like, in the center of your screen, right? So it does look a little bit different.
No.
It was, like, in
the... It was
like
just a random tree.
Of trees.
Okay. Yeah, it was just a whole bunch of trees. And so you really just have to get a type of... thing to burn it, and a specific one, and burn it.
I believe that place is a little suspicious. I think there was like a one tile column, like you kind of like navigate around, just like this like loop you just entered, and
was that suspicious? I feel very frustrated by games that like require walkthroughs in order to play them.
Sure, and that was the other thing that she said, that she suggested some game designers do. They put the solution in the Prima guide, so that you have to buy the Prima guide in order to do it.
Otherwise,
but it's also
does Prima
have
a deal with the?
Oh, you must have. Oh,
yeah.
There's actually
they say official on the top for a reason.
It's also ironic because modern Zelda games like. They hold. It's very obvious that you have to use this or that item.
Like, you got a key. Use this key to open.
Oh, you got this item in the dungeon. You had to use this item to kill the boss. That sort of thing. Like, it's blatant.
Well, for people who are really, really hopeless, there's the little fairy.
Hey, listen.
Usually less useful than you think. But so one big difference between the old Zelda games and the new Zelda games is just this continual refinement in the user interface. It goes all the way from like little things like the notes that you hear when you find a new dungeon, you know, and when you hear exactly when precisely you hear the sound of if I think that's how it sounds, as a clue that now you have opened a door. That's one of those things that if you look at postmodems of Ocarina of Time, I think there's a couple on Gamma Sutra. Exactly when that sound plays is a decision that was very carefully designed. It seems to me that in digital puzzles, in those kinds of like, especially in some sort of narrative structure like in Ocarina, that's the big problem that you have to solve. You have to give enough clues. You have to give enough UI feedback, and you have to think about your UI so hard. In a way that is going to make it possible for people to get all the information they need. So, say that burning fire tree situation, if there's nowhere else in the world for you to get that information, that's bad design puzzle. If there is a guy I can't remember Zelda 1, but if there is a guy who actually tells you that that's the tree that you need to burn, but is it not obvious, especially for someone who hasn't encountered that guy, that that's where you get the information? It's still a bad design puzzle, even though now there's a solution. So thinking about, and some examples will be in a lot of text-based adventures as well as graphical, text-heavy graphical adventures. You have I can't solve this puzzle, but what my character says to the player about why you can't solve the puzzle is self-a-clue. It's like, I must not have the right item. But it's like, you know, maybe there's something else I can use. That's a huge clue.
I feel like digital puzzle games have gotten really good at integrating hint systems in recent years. But I can't think of any physical puzzles that I've come across. There are only just not have caught it, like being up to speed with puzzles that have that kind of not totally revealing the solution but giving you a gradual hint which can help you figure it out.
Well, mystery hunt puzzles kind of
what's me? Oh, tell me.
Well, designed
one. Describe the mystery hunt for folks who don't have this.
It's a competition run at MIT over IAP where teams of people compete to solve a bunch of puzzles, like 70 puzzles that kind of build on each other. So you have, you know, say 20 base puzzles, and you solve those 20 puzzles, you get 20 words as solutions, and then those 20 words become a new puzzle, and it's a meta puzzle, and it kind of keeps going like that for a couple layers. But the point is, the winning team from the previous year writes the next year's mystery hunt, so like you get all kinds of varying puzzles of varying difficulties and styles, and a very well-designed puzzle actually does that, because you have this thing called flavor. I guess I should say that the puzzles aren't like Sudoku or crosswords. You literally just get, you know, something on a screen or something on a piece of paper, and you have to figure out what to do with it. You're not given any instructions for how to solve it whatsoever. And the only clues you get are either by the title of the puzzle, by like the group of puzzles that it's in, or by this thing called flavor text, which is like, they say some kind of random phrase that seems to not have anything to do with anything, but that kind of gives you a clue about what to do in the rest of the puzzle. So that's kind of like what you're describing.
Yeah, it's interesting, because I mean, it's really challenging when you don't have any mechanism for like giving feedback to the person who's working on a puzzle. In Zelda or what have you, you can see that they've spent a long time digging around.
It's kind of a double-edged sword in that particular case, because you have so many mechanisms and now you're expected to use all of them in a game like that. You have to use sound, you have to use contextual buttons, you have to use the inventory, the position of the player matters, you know, something. I've seen games where the main clue is what is the character looking at, for instance, you know, and if you walk around, says, why does my character keep looking that way? Oh, that's the clue, you know. Whereas in a lot of, like, physical stuff, I would say that one of the reasons is if you're starting to build these physical games from toys, a lot of things you could possibly do are kind of built into the physical object. And if you're building a puzzle based on what you could do with these things as a toy, then you're necessarily already using the constraints of what you can do with it as a toy in order to try to create a puzzle. This might be a good exercise, actually. If time, we could take a shot at this and just, like, you know, trying to come up with a puzzle and see. But instead of imagining one in a digital space, trying to imagine one in a physical space. And because I suspect what you actually get is that you get a free ride with physical puzzles, because things physically have interactions that you can use to constrain the puzzle.
I feel like played Portal recently, and that's a game where like the puzzles are, it's not in a, I mean obviously it's still a digital game, but the puzzles are very much physical puzzles. Like you kind of have an idea about what have people played Portal?
Of course.
Mm-hmm. Or know the idea? Okay. I mean you have these two portals, and you understand what the physics is going to be like. So the puzzles aren't frustrating in the sense that it's like, oh, you realize there's like this random statue here, and if you like pull a lever, it like raises the water level or something like that. Like it, I don't know what it is, but it's like, it's very intuitive, and it feels like a physical puzzle in the sense that I know what will happen if I do this, and I just figure out how to put the pieces together. And it also in Portal, what I think does a really good job of, as well as what some physical puzzles do, is having a learning curve. Like Tangram will have some basic puzzles, or I'm sure the following thing, a lot of them have like physical puzzle things where you like, I don't know, have to jump over pieces or whatever, have basic levels, basic boards, where they show you various techniques, and you only have to figure out one technique, and it's very obvious what you have to do, and then later on you have to use those techniques.
Well, I mean, in Tipover, this particular example, it does something that the portal also does really well, is that the very first puzzle that we did earlier only has one solution, and you do not get that solution unless you understand all the mechanics.
Yeah.
Like we tried to solve it a bunch of different times, and it's like because we didn't quite understand the rules, we couldn't get it until we understood the mechanics of the game. Now we can suddenly solve it. So from puzzle number two onwards, we can be confident that we actually know it. Portal, and even actually just about any well-designed game, but I'm going to say Portal's a fine example. If you beat in a game, you can play through the game again with developer commentary, and when you hear that, you will actually realize that every single fairly intuitive physical thing that you pick up in the game had to be taught to you, and they've designed the level very clearly. So right at the beginning of the game, if folks can remember, you're trapped in a little cell, right? And the GLaDOS talks to you, and a portal opens, and you can walk through it. What do you see out of the first portal that opens?
You see yourself going into the other one?
You see yourself going through the other portal. It is like they force you to have to look at what the basic game mechanic is going to be before you can do anything else in the game that's productive in the game. You know, you can pick up the radio, but anyway. So that was a design decision. They could have made that. They could have decided not to make it. They could have made you just go through that into a different room, and a learning opportunity would have been lost right there. So if you got a copy of Portal, I would suggest go back and play through the developer commentaries, because they're hilarious, and they're also really, really good for demonstrating in this room this is what we had to do in order to make people get it. I'm also thinking of things like Mario World 1-1, where like you don't get very far unless you get the basic game mechanics down. But they make it really gentle in that I don't think there are any hits that instantly kill you.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking. Mario, the first Gamma Sutra article we read on late game instructions, mm-hmm. Rich brought up Mario World, and he's like, you expect the same kind of actions to be consistent all the time, jumping. And I guess you can kind of look at like different things there, like double jumping, anything like that, as a specific puzzle, and, like physical in that sense also.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of Mario's things, worlds are laid out basically as spatial puzzles, right? And it's like, you know you have to get there, but you don't know exactly how you're going to use all the mechanics that you've got.
In Mario 64, I think their way of solving the impasse problem of not locking up all the content in the game because of one puzzle you can't get, it's like giving you so much to do that even if they don't really tell you, and even if a good 30-40% are going to remain mysterious to you and you're not going to figure them out, there's so much to jump around between that you're never locked off from a significant amount of content.
So you've got the hub-like structure of, right, like you can do any one of five different things at any given time. Plus you have sort of secondary solutions. Like you can always go back to a world that you've been before and try to put up all the stars. I think that's kind of what Brenda was kind of indicating of the, you don't necessarily want, if you're putting puzzles in your game, she was advocating for, Brenda and Ian were advocating for something that wouldn't necessarily progress on to the next one. But I think that's not a requirement. I think that's if you want to make your life easier, this is what you do. If you decide that you're up to the task, you can achieve some really amazing effects by having your puzzles narratively important. Has anyone heard of the game called Eternal Darkness? It's sort of Lovecraftian horror game on the GameCube. I'll sort of describe it, but basically the whole basic idea is that you have four gods all warring against each other. Three of them hate one of them, but then those three also hate each other. And most of the puzzles are just sort of understanding that there's this mystical logic. You know, one god defeats another god, defeats another god in a rock, paper, scissors circle, and all of them hate this one other thing. Early on in the game, there is actually a puzzle, that there are actually a number of different puzzles where you see the symbols of these gods, and you have to kind of rearrange them in the correct order. And the rest of the game is all going to be like variations on sort of understanding what these gods do to each other. So those are all puzzles that inform you about how the world works. That kind of works in two ways. One information that you've already gathered about the world, about how this world works, gives you clues on how to beat the puzzles. Beating the puzzles, finding the solutions for the clues, gives you information about how the world works. And that's kind of like the holy grail of a puzzle designer in a digital game, is that you're going to design a puzzle that's going to reinforce how the world works. There's a chap who gave a talk, I believe his name is Jeff Howard. He came to Gambit and gave a talk last year. And he makes this case that games and the logic in that you present in games do basically the equivalent of what magic does of what magic systems actually do in the real world. You know, what people like occultists or astrologers, they basically give you logics on that explain how the world is going to work. In one that may not necessarily be obvious, but if you knew this occult knowledge, you'd be able to understand how it's well working you. But more importantly, you'd be able to do things in the world that that allow you to accomplish things that you wouldn't otherwise do. Learning a game is very much like that. You know, it's like, I don't know how this world works, but if I understood these particular rules, I could be able to accomplish greater things. And puzzles can be one of those things where it becomes a test, right? It becomes a test of just exactly how well do you understand this. Even if it's like in a combat game, like Quake or God of War or something, you know, I can understand how the combat system basically works if I just keep mashing the X button or something, or just like shoot everything with rockets. But if I really, really understand the combat system, I might be able to hit something that I wouldn't necessarily be able to hit. I might be able to take down a horde of enemies instead of like taking them down one at a time. I might be able to beat a boss. And actually, a lot of boss battles in digital games are actually puzzles. It's not how well do you generally react. It's can you figure out the pattern? But that pattern doesn't mean anything unless you've already figured out how all your other combat skills work. So a boss battle in Zelda only makes sense if you figured out how that one item that you picked up in that dungeon works really, really well. You know, okay, it shoots fire. That means not only does it hurt things from distance, it also lights some things on fire. And that's what a Zelda boss battle basically is, combining this latest ability that I've got with everything else that you've done before into taking it out. That's why boss battle, that battle's kind of like a puzzle.
Well, one thing I wanted to say before, you know, when you're asking about like hints in a physical puzzle, and the one thing that jumped to my mind was a couple years ago, the Weekly Dig, I don't know if anyone reads it, it's like a free Boston newspaper, and there was a crossword puzzles. For the longest time, they were thematic, and so you would have a guest crosslord, and like the first one I ever did was Hulk Hogan. So all of the hints in the crossword puzzle are related to Hulk Hogan, so it's a question of like, not what does this mean to me, but what would it mean to Hulk Hogan? And they don't do it anymore, which is really depressing, because every week it was somewhat different, and it was like a built-in hint, right? As you didn't just think about it literally, you have to kind of contextualize it.
You can think about all the things that come with the puzzle as potential play figures to introduce hints, like the title, like the flavor text, as you were describing. The fact that it's in the the fact that you get a puzzle in a mystery hunt immediately clues you in that maybe the solution for this lies in a different puzzle, that not the one I'm currently looking at right now, because that's how MIT mystery hunt things are. Metal Gear Solid has a really, really bizarre one where
look in the back case.
Yes, where they tell you, oh, there's a specific radio frequency that you need. It's written in the back of the box, and it's like the back of the box.
That was like or anti-piracy.
Yeah, I mean, yes, but it's still a puzzle. You know, it's like, you know, to solve that. I mean, they were pretty obvious because, or maybe it's just me because it took me about half an hour to figure that one out. Took me some effort.
I mean, Metal Gear Solid did a lot of like meta puzzles like that. Like when you fought Psycho Mantis the first time.
Oh, get this.
So the thing you had to do is you had to unplug your controller and plug it into the second port because he would read your movements. And it was just like, it was this cool like physical layer of it where like you're playing the game and you realize I have to interact with the physical world so that he can't see what I'm doing.
But actually, that one had a loop. Because if you had in that particular example, that one gave you a very big clue. Because right at the beginning of that match, that boss tells you to put your controller on the ground. And he said that I'm going to control this controller with my mind. And actually, just with my brain, right?
That's only if you have DualShock. So since it was on PlayStation, if you didn't, you just ignored that part, and you didn't get that clue at all.
Yeah, that's a problem. But it's still very
clear. There were other clues. There were also other clues, like you would talk about how you had been playing certain games by reading saves on your.
I think it was
on your first
at least not or in Castlevania, Symphony of the Night. Yeah. Those are the ones.
So basically, it's telling you, it's giving you a clue that there's going to be something better about the way that you're currently playing. The funny thing about the radio channel one is that one really did not give you any clue that it was something better. It just told you at the back of the box. It was like, it didn't tell you at the back of the case, the video game case, right? It's not going to be that explicit.
It's a CD case specifically.
Oh, CD case.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
I was really confused because I think mine came in like a slip of paper or something.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you might use it or something. Yeah.
Wow, so it's anti-used game protection as well. But I think mine actually said at the back of the CD case, but I was playing like a re-release or something and that came in the DVD case, so I didn't make that connection. But you know, if you look at the back of it, you see what the radio frequency is in the screenshot. One of the 8 screenshots that they show to demonstrate this is what the game is all about, there's a number just right in there, and then you key it in, like, jeez, that must be half an hour.
They don't play any of those like breakout games. Mm-hmm. Like, if it's locking a room, you have to.
Escape the room.
Exactly. Below this. Yeah, you find clearly like find a slip of paper and just hate those games.
So actually, who doesn't know what these are about? Escape the room. Okay. So escape the room. Actually, could we bring up something on the computer?
Plus, you don't have to grab this video thing.
Well, the video game.
I mean, the adapter in my office.
Oh, okay, cool. In that case, then. Escape the Room games are typically flash games, and they're kind of like adventure games. Because there's usually only one room, although sometimes you have multiple rooms, it's a much smaller world than most adventure games. But the basic idea is the same. You pick up objects, you use objects in a room, and you try to make things happen. You know, if you haven't made anything happen, you are not progressing in the game. If you made something happen, you are almost certainly making forward progress in the game. And there is actually a guide for playing adventure games written by Roberta Williams, who did the original Kingsman series. And her guide is like, pick up everything, go everywhere, use everything on everything. It's like, that's actually what escape room games, but there's a little bit more humane escape room games because there's just not that many places that you can explore. Because the idea is that you're stuck in a room. And basically it comes down to just use everything on everything until you figure out what turns out. Rarely isn't logical, often pretty entertaining because they're animation heavy. So every time you do something right, you get some crazy animation. I put the fish into the mail slot and then out appears an octopus. it's fun to watch. Whereas the kind of combinatorily opposite of those are the Grow games.
Oh, yeah.
And there is a series of games called Grow. I think the guy who does them called Eyes Maze, and that's the E's, not S. And the whole basic idea is that imagine that you have a flower pot, and every time you add something to it, something happens. But the order in which you're adding things to it makes different things happen. Mm-hmm. And there are solutions basically in making the optimal number of things happen if you do it right. So what you can do is not a mystery at all. You know, I have these 6 things that I could add to my pot, and it doesn't. And I know that those are the only 6 things I could add. The question is, what order do I do them? And doing them in different orders gives you different results. I feel that these two genres are kind of linked, but they're playing off very different things. One of them is I don't know what I'm going to do.
but I know that whatever I do is going to be in this space. And the other one is very much, I know exactly what I can possibly do, I just don't know what order to do them. So a couple of puzzles that you see online. These are fairly encapsulated things. One game is one series of puzzles. There's no, it's not like a Professor Layton kind of encyclopedia puzzles kind of thing.
So what time is it?
Okay. Let's see. I think I'm actually going to grab a few more puzzles and bring them in. But I do actually want to try to see whether we can put together a list of the kinds of puzzles that we haven't talked about today. These could be physical puzzles. These could be puzzles that you've seen in a book, but like a genre. Logic puzzles, you know, of a certain kind that you either really, really like or you really, really love. And just break up in groups of 2, 3, 4, 6, 7, 8, 9. I will bring you guys into this. 10, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17 people. 17 people? That doesn't divide at all. Okay, two or three. Groups of two or three, and just like, you know.
Jason should be back.
Oh, okay, all right, okay, then groups of three. And come up with, just like.
I'm good with joining us.
You know, just a couple of puzzles that we haven't discussed, and, you know, and a description about what they're like, and we'll just quickly run through the class to sort of like give everyone an idea of what more. As a toy, playing with a Rubik's Cube is more fun than the algorithm to solve it. That's not fun at all, in my opinion.
Yeah, like Rubik's Cube, it's probably, you can also solve it, but there's algorithms there. It's very tempting to look at it also.
Yeah.
Cool.
Okay.
So, yeah, one of the things you were talking about was interactive fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And,
text
adventures, and how sometimes they could be considered just like, if you're playing a regular adventure game, but just with text instead. And so the puzzle could be how you interact with the world, or it could be trying to figure out what actions are available to the user. Mm-hmm. Like sometimes not all actions are there. But also in some games, the nature of text gives you different ways to have a puzzle, like in a Lost Pig, because you're playing in Bork, he doesn't know English very well, or like doesn't have full control of language, so you're trying to decipher his words to figure out what he's actually seeing.
And is there an example they can do to give with that to make it clearer? No, I haven't played it.
In that game, there's one part where he's describing a box and it has a slot, and you put something in it and then it gets something out. But like the way he's describing it, you don't really know what he's describing until you realize he's talking about a vending machine. he describes it as like a tall box with it. Slot in it. And another example we were talking about was the game Isle, which is you're this guy in like a grocery store, and you have, it gives you like this big prologue, and then you have one action that you can do. So after you type in your one action, it tells you what happens and gives you an epilogue. and then the game starts over. But then using the information from that epilogue, you have a different choice of actions that you can take and different keywords to use.
Interesting.
And so by playing it over and over, you're like uncovering more of the story until you get somewhere.
So the puzzle solution
name is the
UI.
Yeah.
Isle, AISLE.
Yeah, I want to play that too.
Okay, I forgot the name of it. I've been cool
with that game. We also thought about puzzles that were games and put into a very contrived scenario, like bridge puzzles or chess puzzles, or back when the Duelist magazines still existed, the Magic the Gathering puzzles.
So like chess puzzles are like, here's this board, what was the move that got to this board?
Like black to win in three moves.
Yeah.
Something like that.
So that's like, you are now placing additional constraints on the game
Yeah, exactly. It already puts you in a situation like, pretend you're in this game, now we promise you there's a way you can automatically win, you have to find it.
Yeah. There's a number of sort of computer games like Choo Choo Rocket and everything, where that's like just a completely separate mode.
What's it called?
Choo Choo Rocket is a frenetic four player.
It's a mice herding game.
Mice herding game.
You have to get them into rocket ships.
Yeah,
so they can go into space.
It is.
It's for the Dreamcast.
It's so good.
But they're porting it to
iPhone. Oh,
really?
Oh,
really? The idea is there's just a whole bunch of mice wandering around the street, and each player gets to place like three arrows, and whenever the mice run into the arrow, they follow the arrow. So you want to get all the mice in the ship, so you want to get the cats in the other ship so they eat their mice.
And puzzle mode says you have three arrows in these particular directions, figure out where to place them as much time as you want, but there's only one right answer. And that immediately shows you the difference between game and puzzle, right there. You can build your own same package.
Cool. So, first off, I don't like jigsaw puzzles, but Michelle loves them. And then we also talk about whodunits. And I really love whodunits because it's like what you have to pay attention to the detail in the story. It's like the one thing that, like, I guess the example that we were talking about is if there's a mailman and it happens to be on a Sunday, he probably committed the crime because they don't have mail on Sundays. And it's like small details like that.
Are you talking about mystery books?
Yeah.
Just like little paragraphs.
Well, it's usually like a story and they say, like, oh, here's the scenario, here's the background story, who is the murderer? Who's the murderer?
They compiled it books, even.
Yeah.
Here's like 100 different versions.
So. People also have parties like that, like full-on whodunit parties. Right?
Yeah, that's very true.
Yeah, how do those?
I didn't see you was talking for a second. That was
really
who's talking? That's the
whodunit. Did we actually skip over you, you guys?
Another puzzle that we came up with was the ones that you didn't know in middle school with, like, the big grid, and you would have, you know, like, someone's name and maybe their favorite food, and you'd be given a bunch of clues, and you have to match them. Yeah, with, like, the checks and the X's and stuff.
So,
they're
just generally called logic puzzles, yeah. I mean. And it's just, you're given the incomplete set of information, but enough constraints that you can figure out the rest of the information. And really, the way to solve it is just, like, write everybody's name, all the characters that you're given in a piece of prose. Write down all the characters on one column. Write down all the things that you're trying to figure out, like who's wearing what color shirt, for instance. So just write out all the colors on the other column. And just by the process of elimination, just figuring out. Usually the answers are mutually exclusive, right? So like if somebody's wearing a red shirt, the person cannot be wearing a green shirt. So yeah,
they're like much harder ones. Where, like, every fourth statement is false. Like you don't know if one statement is definitely false. Mm-hmm. I've seen ones where every statement is false except for one. They're like I can bring it in my book if they're just like
idiots. Bring it up instantly. You could. The worst version of that is figuring out how to see people in the wedding.
Is anyone in 6034? Because we pretty much did that last week.
Oh, yes.
Oh,
cool. Yeah.
Share property.
You guys want to throw in any?
Sure. We started by trying to think of all the puzzles that we really dislike. And we came up with a couple here. The sliding square puzzles, you have like a basically just a variation on a jigsaw puzzle where the wheels are more constrained. I don't like jigsaw puzzles either. It's like-minded there. And then John had a couple like lights out. I guess there's a lights out puzzle.
Oh,
it's like you touch certain areas and illuminates it. And you have to like flip them off.
So you've got a like a grid of buttons, and every button you push will invert all these neighboring buttons. Like in, I think the top, bottom, left, and right will flip.
Yeah, every card has the board.
Yeah. And then I guess a similar, well, maybe not similar, but there's. Why don't you describe the concentric circles?
Yeah, their puzzles are similar to that, where taking an action on one item in the scene will. These are really digital puzzles. The concentric circle ones will. Have effects on other things in the system, and typically these are used in games where there'll be like a center podium with a pathway leading off of one side of the podium, and there'll be a concentric circle around that, a concentric ring with a pathway off of that ring at another angle, and then more and more circles on each side, and you get to rotate individual circles, and that will rotate the other circles in different ways, and you need to create a pathway.
Every time I rotate one, something else is going to rotate.
Yeah. And those are always thrown in, like, it's always thrown in, like, right before, like, a boss battle, and you're just like, oh, damn it.
I guess three of those are examples of games where, like, you have to take action on an environment, but your action has indirect effects, you know, throughout the environment, and it's just really annoying figuring out how to optimize that.
But they are predictable effects. So it's like, every time I rotate this one left, that one's going to rotate right.
Right.
I think it's kind of funny how, like, the context has a lot to do with where these puzzles are going or not, because, like, I do enjoy Professor Layton quite a bit. And it's, like, it's the most, sort of arbitrary narrative, like, justifying that they're trying puzzles in the world, but, like, it's just fun. And so it's, like, your intentionality when playing the game is that you're going to be solving puzzles, and that has something to do as well.
It's not like in the middle
and
of the
way
that,
also the way that that is presented kind of makes it funny in math as well, right? So like the mafia goons come up to you and say, "We're going to stop you from coming in here unless you can solve this puzzle." Shouldn't you just shoot me? Solve all your problems. No, no, solve this puzzle.
No, it's not. They're making fun of themselves even.
All right, cool. I'm not sure if we really commented on what we liked or didn't like, but some things that we came up with that haven't been brought up yet are cryptics, which are kind of a combination between like crossword and riddles. Riddles, combinatorial games as a puzzle genre, logic puzzles in general, not just like typical logic puzzles like that. You can have like state machines or Sudoku or any type of numerical puzzle. We also wanted to differentiate that a lot of those games, or some of those games, are spatially oriented and some aren't, which we thought was an important aspect, but not necessarily definitive of a completely different genre.
I'm not sure if I've seen a state machine puzzle, actually, outside of like computer science textbook.
I know some. I really like state
I'll have to ask you. I suspect it's going to be more involved than we have time for. By combinatorial puzzles, you mean stuff like you have
combinatorial games,
like okay. Minecraft.
All the games that fall under combinatorial game theory.
Okay.
The theory.
So like NIMH
puzzles.
Like NIMH.
Yeah.
Everything was in very academic.
Cool.
That's a lot of games.
I see real sort of exploration. So games where you have to see everything around you to know what is available for use. On the Braithwaite. In the book, they talked about Zelda.
Yeah.
And just other. So, a game, like a situation in a game that I didn't like is you're playing a game and something happens, you don't step too fast or something, and because of that, you get to an irreversible spot where you don't have the tools necessary to beat the enemy right in front of you, but you also are trapped and can't go back. It happened to me one time. It was a Star Wars Knights of the Old Republic, and There's an enemy I couldn't go forward. There was an enemy you couldn't go forward, and the door, or like, there was a cliff, so you couldn't get back up.
Uh-huh.
And so, since I couldn't do anything, I was forced to actually completely go back to, like, the last save.
Wait, but is that a puzzle, or is that just a bug?
I mean, it was, like, it's a time where it's exploration, and it's an item use, so you need to get an item to go ahead and complete. Like, if you have this item, then the enemy that you, I think it was like a Rancor or something, you could beat the Rancor, or at least put it to sleep and walk by it. But without it, you had to try and just beat it, or it would kill you.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so it was an item that will have made combat easier, basically,
yes.
But then it was kind of, they kind of made it this one way.
Uh-huh.
It's like, yeah, so you see a lot of puzzle games where they have like easy reset, right? It's like, you know, you can start trying to solve it and you realize you screw up something along the way, you hit reset and go back right back to the beginning. Knights of the Republic has no easy reset. Yeah, like you live with the consequences. I guess that's what they were trying to go for. But.
Alright, so we also had a loading room. Sliding puzzles, either with numbers or with pictures, both of them are equally annoying. But on the other hand, Alec loves Rush Hour, and
it's the traffic crunch. You have to slide cars out of the way to form a path.
Cars are better than tasks.
In Professor Layton, there are an awful lot of sliding puzzles that have like differently shaped pieces or oddly shaped pieces. which is slightly more interesting or less annoying than sliding puzzles, but like regular sliding puzzles, but it's still incredibly frustrating.
Well, I think the difference there is that when you have differently sized pieces, like when you're doing just like a sliding puzzle where you're trying to recreate an image, there's definite patterns that you keep using over and over again because you're just like rotating spaces.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not actually interesting, whereas Rush Hour, you actually have to like think about how things fit together.
Mm-hmm.
So one other puzzle type that we haven't really mentioned that I actually really enjoy is like pictographic puzzles, where it relies on sort of your association with visual images and like wordplay and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, you'll have a puzzle that's just, you know, an image of an eyeball, a bumblebee, and a screenshot of Judi Dench in like in a James Bond movie. And the idea is it's IBM. So like I love puzzles like that.
Those are Rebus puzzles.
So stuff like that where it relies on someone like a human being actually associating information with something visual rather than it being just like a straight logic puzzle where you have this you know this information and you use this to derive the rest of the information.
That's REBUS, and of course those are very language focused, even though they're image based. So,
but like the one that has the two lines and then read in the middle.
You have Rebus where you're trying to like basically reconstruct a sentence, and then I forget what's the classification of puzzles where you're given some assembly of images and you're trying to like you know. If I wrote in what's the one? This is not a good puzzle, but just to give an example. If I put you know
wheels.
This is kind of visual puns. I think there is a specific word for these kind of things, but the whole idea is trying to reconstruct the same or the reconstruct sentence from visual cues. These are usually spatial to begin with, but I think there was a whole game show in the 80s that was just all.
That's awesome. That's great.
In Australia, they had a show called Catchphrase, which was
I think Catchphrase was the show.
So we wrote a big list of different types of puzzles. So we've got, let's just run through them. Right, we've got lots of different sliding puzzle variants. We've got hidden object finding. If anyone's done Where's Waldo, then it's kind of a similar deal. We have riddles, various kinds of logic puzzles, particularly two which we've mentioned before. Somebody who has several people, witnesses give statements, one of them's a liar, which one's a liar? So find the inconsistent person. And there's the thing with property X is next to thing with property Y. What order are they sitting in? That kind of puzzle. There's a million of them in Professor Layton. There's these kinds of unraveling or reverse engineering type puzzles where some system has been permuted and you have to restore it to its original state, of which Rubik's Cube is like the canonical example, I guess, but then there's a bunch of other different ones.
Oddly enough, chess games kind of fit in that category too.
There's like tile rotation and swapping puzzles. Like one example of this is Bioshock hacking, but then there are a million other variations on exchanging tiles or swapping them around or this kind of thing. Lots of different kinds of math puzzles. This particular word transformation puzzle type that I used to see all the time when I was a kid, where by changing one letter of a word per step, you have to transform one word into another. Mazes, jigsaw puzzles, code breaking, nobody even mentioned yet. And then also these kind of thought experiment-y type puzzles. I don't know how else to categorize them.
Give us an example.
Alright, so I'm trying to remember how this works, but I think it is. This one popped up on Day 9's podcast the other day. I don't want to give it because otherwise, if I get it wrong, then people will go, oh my god, and try and puzzle it out.
Let me see if I can remember.
To do with the piece of string and burning.
Oh, the 15 minutes?
Yeah. Do you remember exactly how it works?
Yes. You have two pieces of string. You know that the whole string takes an hour to burn, but it's not linear. So like, you don't, it's not linear. You have an infinite supply of matches. How can you measure 15 minutes with this string?
Yeah. Those are lateral thinking puzzles.
Yeah, but yeah. Lateral thinking puzzles. I guess. Mm-hmm.
I think they're. I would classify those under riddles, but
yeah.
Two identical pieces.
They both take an hour to burn non-linearly. Couldn't you just be lighting matches the entire time and see how many matches you can burn an hour after I just take four of that number? No, but like, then how are you going to measure that original hour?
This assumes that I measure.
But you know that them thing takes an hour to burn.
The whole thing. Let's assume it's slightly longer than the amount of time we have in class. We could, but then it would be nice to give people time to think about it too.
Yeah.
So answer on Wednesday.